Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Well, a big thanks to Roz, Emma and Graham for driving us through the afternoon. It is Wednesday, December 4th. I'm Shane Dawson and you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show with Beto da Silva at 7pm, Keith Tracy chats Premier League with a packed midweek schedule on the cards. Peter Smith does in from Manchester ahead of the Champions clash with Nottingham Forest, and sticking with soccer, Rebecca Cray reflects on a disappointing night for Ireland at Lansdowne. And we'll turn our attention to the UFC because Ian Garry joins us on the line ahead of his co-main event in Las Vegas on Saturday. Plus, we have a chance for one lucky listener to win €400 with thanks to Kellogg's. As always, if you want to get in touch, you can send us a text on 51552, WhatsApp 087-187-9200, or we're on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Good evening. Welcome along to the show. Welcome along to an hour of sport on 2FM. Good evening, Keith Tracy. How are you?
I'm very well, Shane. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, sir. Rebecca Cray, how's the form?
All good. Can't complain.
Better than it was last night, I would imagine.
A little bit. We're getting there.
Yeah, a difficult night at Lansdowne, and we will get stuck into that, the post-mortem, and reflect on that before we chat Premier League later on. And indeed, Ian Garry will join us on the line. A couple of news headlines first to kick off the show. And starting with football, actually, Michael McDermott, a former assistant coach at Carlos Queiroz with Iran and Qatar, has been announced as new co-Ramblers boss. McDermott brings expertise from high levels of the game, including the FIFA World Cup and Asian Champions League. McDermott assisted Queiroz with Iran at the 2018 World Cup before briefly linking up with him again in the middle of 2023 with Qatar. The Belfast man's career spans multiple continents, although he had one role closer to home as manager of Glentoran, where he won an Irish Cup in 2020. Ramblers, of course, finished in 8th spot in this year's First Division, 7 points off to playoffs. So, an interesting appointment. Would you agree, Keith?
Left of field, I think. Obviously has a very good CV, having been under Carlos Queiroz and been around FIFA World Cup. So, great cue for Cove Ramblers and see how it equates onto the pitch.
Yeah, an interesting appointment. The FAI, this is interesting, has apologised after last night's match programme against Wales, portrayed a map of Ireland featuring the term Londonderry. The graphic displayed the 32 counties of Ireland with details of where each player of the women's team was from around the island. County Derry was identified as Londonderry rather than Derry. Former Ireland international James McLean posted a picture of the graphic with a caption of disgusting, pathetic and insulting. So the FAI have apologised for that. It's their second faux pas. I think another RTE website has all the details of some peculiar translations from the Latvia match programme, but do log on to the website to see full details of that. Andrew O'Connor and Ruby Walsh chatted snooker yesterday, and following up on that, Joe Shannon came agonisingly close to victory in the World Snooker Tour as he fell to defeat to Robert Milkins in the first round of the snooker shootout in Leicester. The 14-year-old from Longford built a 42-1 lead but missed the black off the spot to give Milkins an opening. The veteran Englishman reduced the lead by 20 points and was then handed another chance in the final 2 minutes of the one-frame match. Milkins moved into a 45-42 lead and let the clock run down to ensure a narrow victory. A second Irish amateur also featured today is Joel Connolly from Belfast, was beaten by Cork's Aaron Hill 39-12 in an all-Irish clash. Defending champion Mark Allen made it through with Scotland's Ross Moore causing few problems in the opening clash of the tournament. Final news headline. Alex Dunn has today been named as the Motorsport Ireland Press International Driver of the Year for 2024. The 18-year-old from County Offaly has been one of Ireland's fastest rising single seat racers over the last few years and is currently part of the McLaren F1 Driver Development Programme. Max Hart from Wicklow won the Young Driver of the Year, while Craig Rahal was named as the Young Rally Driver of the Year, which he received the Billy Coleman Award. After the ceremony, Alex Dunn spoke to our own John Kenny.
Things are only going in the right direction. The goal for next year is F2, and I think every day, every week, pretty much that goal is becoming more and more realistic. Next week, I'll be heading to Abu Dhabi doing the official postseason F2 test, and I think we'll have to wait and see how that goes. But I think the possibility of F2 for next year is looking very strong and very likely. So once we make it to F2, we're only one step below my dream, which is Formula One. So yeah, things are going in the right direction. The support's been very good. You know, for Motorsport Ireland at home, McLaren as well. You know, the support I've had recently has been very strong, and we're going in the right direction.
Okay. Tell us about the McLaren development program. How did that come about?
Well, to be honest, it was a bit random. You know, I didn't really know much about it at the time. My dad was kind of the one who was dealing with it. You know, he pretty much manages my whole career, so any of the phone calls about it or anything like that, he all got directly. And I remember one day that he got a phone call, and then he called me straight away and said, Alex, we're going to MTC, which is the McLaren Technology Centre, because we have a meeting about the driver development program. And I was a little bit shocked. I didn't really know what to say. And then I had a meeting there at the time with one of their engineers, Stephanie Carlin, Emanuele Pirro, and Zach Brown. And then I think, I want to say it was 2 or 3 weeks later when we were driving home from a test I was doing. And we got the text that it was going ahead and that they wanted me to be a part of the McLaren driver development program. So, yeah, definitely. I think that was the first. Normally, I'm not a very emotional person, but I think that was the first time in recent years of my career where I got quite emotional. And I think being a part of McLaren for me was a massive thing. And you know, even getting to F3 this year, McLaren's are the one who made that possible. Without them, I wouldn't have been able to do F3. And the same thing with moving forward. So they've played a big part in it for me.
Game on 2FM.
Now, competition time. To celebrate the launch of Kellogg's Christmas GAA quiz and the RT Christmas Guide, Kellogg's are giving Game On listeners the chance to win €400 every day this week. Get the RT Christmas Guide out on December 9th and test your GAA knowledge over Christmas with unbelievable prizes to be won, including an all-inclusive trip to New York City. So, to be given a chance to win €400 today, answer the following question. Joe Canning played hurling for which county? Text your answer, name and email address to 51552, and before the end of the show this evening, we'll pick one correct entry randomly and give them that €400, all thanks to Kellogg's. As always, RT competition terms and conditions apply. See 2fm.ie for details.
Game on.
Football.
But we're chatting football. We're chatting women's football. We're chatting Irish international football with Keith Tracy and Rebecca Cray. A disappointing night, as I mentioned at the top of the show, for Ireland yesterday. Why did it get away from Ireland, in your opinion, Rebecca?
Yeah, I think we started the game well. The first half, you know, it was a bit frantic to start off with, but I thought we dominated the ball, you know, the first half. We just didn't seem to take our chances. I think we had a good effort from Denise O'Sullivan, hit off the crossbar. And then it was just a case, I thought, getting in at, you know, half time and come out all guns blazing in the second half. But as soon as that penalty went against Ireland in the early stages of the second half, it just kind of took the wind out of our sails slightly. You know, I don't think it's something that they'd kind of planned for. You know, I think going into the game, the girls were quite confident, you know, thought that we could maybe take it on home soil. But, yeah, unfortunately, it wasn't to be.
If we are to try and paint a positive picture on this, and I know it's extremely disappointing, Keith, not qualifying for a major tournament and qualifying for first European Championships after the achievement of getting to a World Cup, which was an unbelievable achievement, and it was good to see that women's football was on the upward trajectory. We see the TV figures going up, attendance is going up in the Women's League of Ireland as well. But Rita Littlejohn gave a very mature interview immediately after such a devastating defeat and kind of mentioned about, now is the time for grassroots revolution. So perhaps this will wake up the powers that be that we do need change across the board, both boys and girls football, starting from the ground up.
Yeah, of course we do. And I thought Littlejohn spoke really, really well after the game. She would have been really, really emotional. But to keep ahead and get her point across like she did, I thought was really, really good. So, look, I don't think she's told anybody, you know, I don't think it's news to anybody. Everybody knows that we need help. We need all sorts of investment. We need resources that aren't quite there. So, look, we can look at that. And I do think everything that Littlejohn said is absolutely spot on. But I don't think that's the reason we lost the game last night. You can look at that and think, oh, well, it's all, you know, building blocks into place. And that's why we've lost that game against Wales. That's not quite it. I think the penalty was a huge, huge call. I do think if you jump with your arm out in an unnatural position, and I know it just flicks off somebody's head just in front of the centre half and it hits her in the arm. But I think if your arm's out in that position, you're always going to give the referee a chance. And the reaction from the Irish women after the penalty went in, I thought we could have done a little bit better. We were still a little bit passive, and I think we did look a little bit nervous. We like the weight of the world was on our shoulders. The whole weight of Ireland was on the Irish women's team. And yeah, I think we were a little bit reactive. We waited for Wales to really bop us on the nose twice. We conceded two goals. And then when we started putting balls into the box, we started asking questions. All of a sudden, the Welsh didn't look as well drilled, didn't look as organised, didn't look as comfortable when balls came into the box. And yeah, the last 10 minutes, we really put them under the cosh. We'd one cleared off the bar, one cleared off the line. Denise O'Sullivan hit the post in the first half. But the first half was absolutely fine. We felt our way into the game. It was nip and tuck, not an awful lot in it. But as you say, the second half, we expected to go up the levels and we just didn't seem to have it. And a lot of people are talking about the age profile. I thought the two, probably three best players for Wales last night was Rachel Rowe and Jessica Fishlock. Rachel Rowe is 32 and Fishlock is 37. So I don't think we can be pointing just at the girls' age. I think it was a poor performance in general, but that Aviva pitch, it was a rainy, windy night. It's had a lot of rugby played on it. I don't think, you know, a football-based style was always going to be difficult for the women. But look, we were in League A in the Nations League. It was a very, very tough group. We managed to turn over France. We were competitive in a lot of the games, although we lost them. So we battered Georgia in the last leg of this and we just came out the wrong side against Wales. So I wouldn't be pressing the panic button, although everybody knows, look, we made the World Cup, we could have made the Euros, and I really do think it was the flip of a coin. I don't think anybody sitting here, Wales outclassed us. Wales were much, much better than us. I think it was just a little bit unlucky on the night.
Mm. I know I'm trying to paint the positive picture in terms of this might ignite the fire, reignite the fire about grassroots reform, and that obviously isn't the reason, as Keith mentioned, that we lost yesterday. But how big of a setback is this, do you feel, for women's football on the international level, not qualifying for a major tournament?
I wouldn't go to that extreme, to be honest. Like, I think over the last 2 years or so, we've come on leaps and bounds. You know, obviously qualifying for our first major tournament. Obviously, look, we made that step up as well to League A. I don't think you'd have ever got a group, you know, it's quite rare that you get a group of England, France and Sweden, three of the major players in Europe, do you know what I mean? So to kind of to put it up to those teams, obviously we didn't come out the best side of it in terms of results. Obviously France was the one we actually did. But look, I wouldn't be, as Keita said, panicking just yet. You know, people are going on about the grassroots reform. I think there's been a lot of volunteers throughout the years that have been trying to, you know, bring that through from the ground up. Resources are limited, you know, finances are limited. We're all well aware of that. But I think there's a huge gap between our underage, you know, setup and the senior squad. How are we ever going to, you know, bring players through that system when, you know, Eileen's bringing in young players for that experience? They're not getting game time. They're not getting, you know, minutes on the pitch. I think it's crying out for an under-23 side to be brought into the four. So you can have that kind of ladder there for the girls to work their way through and be just about ready to play at the senior level after the under-19 sides.
Yeah, between that and even the home-based training squad. And
that went out the window, the home-based training sessions as well. So
because it's a huge step up, I'd imagine, in men's or women's football, going from under, not even under-21s, but under-19s senior football.
I think I'm back of, I played for Ireland at every age group, underage group, and from under-15s, under-19s, I played for an under-21s team, I played for a B team, I played for an under-23s team as well at one point when we went to Malaysia for a couple of weeks in the summer. So yeah, from 19 getting thrown into it's a massive jump. It's asking a lot of them. And look, there will be, you know, the odd exception where somebody 18, 17 jumps in and they take to like a fish to water. But generally, 19 to senior football is a big, big jump. You're asking a lot there.
Will we see a couple of retirements given the age profile?
Potentially. Look, you don't like to put that on anyone, or, you know, obviously make those kind of assumptions. But like, obviously you still have Niamh Fahey there, still captain in Liverpool over in the WSL, still playing good football. Obviously she's been kind of dampened with injuries over the last few years as well. Louise Quinn, I know, is currently out injured, also has a you know, kind of other personal kind of stuff in terms of engagements and, you know, babies on the way and all those kind of good things. And, you know, obviously then with Roosh, a little John, she's 34 now. And yeah, look, it's one of those things. I think the girls need to take a bit of time now over the next month or two, just to take some time away from the game of our international setup to maybe have a think about what they're going to do going forward. You know, they've been great servants to the game. But I'd like to think that they won't be making any kind of rash decisions just yet.
How will Katie and the group respond, do you feel, to a defeat of... Because they looked utterly distraught on the pitch afterwards.
Yeah, obviously, look, knowing Katie personally, she was obviously devastated, you know, and it's not something that I've ever seen in her, I think, to be so visibly upset. it kind of looked like it was a case that we've got so far and just didn't seem to, you know, get it over the line. And look, they'll just, they're professional girls at the end of the day, you know, they go back to club football now, see out the year in terms of domestic things. And yeah, just take that well-needed break, I think. It's been constant over the last year or two for them. But look, you know, I think we've seen there, Megan Connolly has said that life does go on, you know, and football moves on and it comes around very, very fast. So look, they're well well tuned in that they'll pull up their socks and go again.
Ciara Caruso said the best is yet to come. Would you agree?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. Look, I think we have great youth within our system. Some great footballers now within that squad, you know, that have got a lot of potential and a lot to show still. You know, and I think given that we put the right kind of time and investment and effort into this squad and into players around this country, and, you know, if there is still girls further afield that we may not even be aware of, you know, to pick out that bit of talent throughout Europe and even the world, yeah, I think the best is yet to come. But we just need to keep, you know, staying on top of it, obviously invest in the grassroots, maybe look at the under 23 set up our own domestic league here as well, to try and bring that on and hopefully grow the women's game further here.
When we look at the leaders, perhaps Katie was lucky to be on the pitch. Kate, or Keith, I should say. Katie McKay was lucky to be on
the weekend. and
Eileen Gleeson, then the main leader, the person in charge, who gave a robust post-match interview with Tony O'Donoghue. Is there any concern that perhaps when there's been any negativity surrounding the team that it gets a bit too confrontational in the media dealings in that regard?
Possibly, but look, it's one of those. I think whenever the Irish women's team lose a game of football, the first thing that people are going to speak about was Katie McCabe, and can we play her somewhere other than left back? Can we put her in the middle of the pitch or somewhere slightly more forward where she can have a little bit more say in it? It's always going to be the way, but a lot of people are saying to me this Irish team has gone backwards. I don't think that's particularly the case. I think the level of opposition they're playing against has gone up, and you're going to lose games. You know, like I say, we were very, very competitive in the Nations League, although we lost, you know, points on the board wasn't good enough, but competitive performance wise we were okay. And you know, I think this Irish team is on a knife edge. You know, the likes of it, Denise O'Sullivan, Katie McCabe, are at that age now where you're thinking, we're going to find out how good professionals you are now, because if you're not a good professional and you're getting to the age of 30, mid-30s, the aches and pains, the bumps and bruises, they hurt you a lot more than they should have. So if the girls go away and they are being professional and they're living their life properly, there's no reason they can't get another couple of years out of each of these players. So, like I say, I'm still a million miles away from pressing the panic button. We came out the wrong side of a very, very tight game, but I do think tactically, hindsight's a brilliant thing, but tactically I think we were a little bit naive in the fact that we tried to play a little bit more football. And maybe the Welsh manager coming out and saying Ireland are a very back to front team, very, very physical, maybe that made us think about it a little bit more than we should have, and we maybe should have just embraced it that little bit more. But look, again, I thought we could have easily won that game last night. You know, just a little bit unlucky that we've ended up losing it.
Yeah, I think Maeve de Burke made the point as well last night about perhaps if we had brought the subs on a bit sooner, but again, hindsight is a wonderful thing. Eileen Gleeson, the contract is up now. Does she deserve a new contract with the Irish team, Rebecca?
Yeah, in my opinion, look, I thought she done well, you know, over the course of her tenure. Like, she obviously came up against, as we mentioned already, some stiff opposition, you know, put in some great performances. You could kind of see the life back in the girls and going into camp, you know, the smiles on the faces, you know, all that kind of excitement to actually go in, when previously, I know, in years gone by, there might have been that little bit of dread, you know, going into a camp for a week or two or whatever it may be. And she brought in a great team around her in Colin Healy, obviously, and Emma Byrne, and you know, Evie Casagrande as well as the strength and conditioning coach. So look, she I thought gave her a best shot at it, you know, and obviously she knows the league, she knows the players. And look, you look at the FAI now, it might be a case that it might be a financial decision on their side. You know, it's probably the cheapest option to keep Eileen in there, and it's easier maybe to go looking elsewhere as well. So look, I can't see them going further afield, to be honest with you. I think they might give her another bash at it.
And she'd be best placed to nurture this new talent coming through, the Izzy Atkinsons, the Abby Larkins, and progress their careers.
Yeah, I'd like to think so. Look, they've only come out on the positive side when they spoke about Eileen. You know, and it seems to be the case that, look, we obviously for the last few games we've kind of relied on that, you know, kind of older crew that have been knocking around for a while now. And I think this kind of break will maybe see the younger girls, the likes of Abby and Izzy, come through, and maybe even Mangan back in the squad, Ellen Malloy. You know, there's still some great girls that haven't been in the last two squads, just gone there, that I think, you know, gone into new year, we may see more of.
Mm. And you can learn a lot from defeats, and defeats of this magnitude as well, that this will stick with players and that hurt can be used and harnessed in a positive manner, I'd imagine.
Yeah, of course. This is always something that will be brought up, and, you know, when March rolls around, whenever the internationals it is rolls around for the women, sorry, they'll tell it, and I'm sure Eileen or whoever the manager is will say, remember the horses felt after that Welsh game, use it as fuel, don't ever have that feeling again. And as long as you have that and you keep it and you bottle it and you use it as fuel for up and coming games, then there's no problem. But, you know, I think something that's been thrown at the Irish men over the last couple of months is it doesn't hurt them enough. And when you see the women out on their feet after, you know, Katie is emotional as she was, you can tell it hurts the women. And I wouldn't say I like that, but as a professional, when you see them hurting after a game, you go, yeah, that's exactly the way it should be. And as long as they dust themselves down and bounce back as they should, there's absolutely no problem.
Did it hurt benefit ye in your careers? Did it benefit yourself?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. You have to use it as fuel.
Mm-hmm. Most definitely.
The last thing we want is another managerial hunt that drags on for 12 to 18 months as well, I suppose. Listen, before we wrap up the conversation, the Women's League of Ireland Awards were on as well. Julianne Russell was named the SSC Electricity Women's Premier Division Player of the Year. The Galway United ace has, of course, enjoyed a remarkable year, including a return to the national team following a four-year absence and winning the Avenir Sports All-Ireland Cup. Russell was selected as the Player of the Year ahead of Athlone Town Trio, Madison Gibson, Roisin Molloy and Laurie Ryan, as well as Shelburne duo Maggie Pearce and Pearl Slattery. Ireland Women's Under-19 goalkeeper Katie King claimed the Young Player of the Year award following a superb season with champions Athlone, who had Kieran Clough win the Manager of the Year prize. An event to celebrate the winners was held ahead of the match last night. The event included honouring Liam Ward and Gordon Ewing for their long service as administrators with Shelburne, as well as former match official Michelle O'Neill, who recently retired. I think that came to news to Liam Ward and Gordon Ewing, two great servants of women's football for Shells.
Yeah, most definitely, taken by surprise, no doubt. Gordon, I don't think he even made it to the awards, but yeah, no, look, it's great to see them get the recognition, you know, over the course of time that they've given, obviously, to football and obviously Shelburne as well. But yeah, really, really good.
Interesting time for the awards, kind of somewhat shoehorned into.
Questionable, yeah, yeah. Look, for me, it was just lazy, to be honest with you. You know, you look at the PFAI, how they put on a bit of a spectacle in the last 2 weeks, you know. For me to see the FAI awards just slipped into, you know, before a women's game at the Aviva. I think a lot of players weren't even available there. Mams and dads were going to collect awards as well, you know. So organising things like that, just, you know, before games, just isn't my cup of tea. I think the girls deserve a little bit more than that. As well, so look, hopefully it's something that they might take on board and go back to what they used to do, you know, when we actually had full blown awards for the league, you know, our Irish league. So look, hopefully, yeah, going forward it might change.
It's a token gesture, isn't it? Side of the pitch before the game, it's a token gesture. Nobody's really interested in
it. To be fair to the FAI, there was a room and there was a setup. It wasn't.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, just for clarity for our listeners.
It should be the main thing, shouldn't it? The girls have worked hard all year, and the awards are a big night. And you know,
like
as a player,
exactly.
They should have just. It should have been the main thing. You know, the game is as a little side caveat to the game. I think it was a standalone piece that the girls should have been able to enjoy.
Yeah. Final word: Julianne Russell and Kieran Clough taking the player and manager. You're fully deserving, I would imagine.
Most definitely. Look, Kieran, you know, the. Achievements he's had this year speak for themselves. You know, he's brought that club on the last 2 years massively, and obviously Julianne, given the kind of circumstances of going away and having a baby and working as hard as she does, you know, to come back into the Irish squad and do so well with Galway, it's magnificent, delightful.
Yeah, baby Rosie, the most famous baby in Ireland, I think.
Yeah,
listen, Rebecca, thanks so much for popping in to studio. Keith, you're sticking around. Peter Smith will be joining us a little bit later as we chat Premier League, but up after the break, Ian Garry dials in from Las Vegas ahead of his co-main event in the UFC. Now joining me on the line, I'm delighted to say, is Ian Machado Garry, ahead of a co-main event this Saturday in Las Vegas, UFC 310, coming up against a daunting rival, it has to be said, Shavkat Rakhmonov. Massive occasion this Saturday, Ian, so how's the form? Are you excited?
Dude, it's hard not to be excited when you're driving around Vegas, you see your face all over the posters, and you're living that dream that kid in Dublin was sat there going, one day I'm going to do this, and we're living it right now. So energy's great, and I'm excited for this weekend.
You're literally driving around at the moment as I speak to you. Probably looking at yourself in the posters, are you?
I'm looking at the beautiful mountains of Las Vegas, Nevada at the moment as I drive to work. But I promise you, my face is way prettier than those mountains.
Do you enjoy that aspect of it? All the attention on you?
Yes and no. In different ways. It's obviously nice when you see, because I've never dreamt of fame. Fame has not been something I've ever wanted. But appreciation and respect for my talents and my skill set is something that matters to me, because I want people to be able to sit here and say, in years to come, this kid is one of the greatest fighters we've ever seen on this earth. So for me, that's what I look for. And then when I bring joy and excitement to people, they're like, oh my God, you're Ian Mitchell. And then they lose their mind and they're just like, can we get a photo? That's obviously amazing as well. And you can change someone's day, just them seeing you walk down the road or in the shop. That's pretty cool.
Well, to become the greatest of all time, I'd imagine it is a case of one fight at a time. So looking ahead at squaring off against Shavkat on Saturday, he's 18-0, a monster in this division. So just how daunting is that prospect for you?
I mean, people keep talking about him being the scariest man in the division, and he's this boogeyman. And I'm sat here going, all I've ever done in my career is win. All I've ever done is beat whoever's been in front of me. So Saturday night, I'm going to do it in the most beautiful fashion I possibly can against the dangerous guy I've ever faced against. And the world is going to be left speechless.
So what is doing it in the most beautiful fashion that you can imagine?
Leave him looking like he's been hit by a truck. Chop him down. Beat him up. Beat him at his own game. Do whatever needs to be done to get my hand raised and shock everyone else's world, because my world won't be remotely shocked.
A former sparring partner as well, of course. How does that affect the contest?
Training is training. It gives us slight little understandings of maybe who would be faster. And, you know, it's obvious from watching fights that Shavkat has and leans into more of his grappling than I do. So it's a case of we kind of understand each other's skill set, but we've never gone in 100% to each other. We've never fought each other in the gym. So Saturday night, whatever happened in training is regardless. It all matters on the line. UFC 310, December 7th, co-main event. All the marbles are on the line for this co-main event.
Now, shots have been fired from his camp. He's claimed that he did make you tap in one of these sparring sessions. Does that just add a bit of fuel to the fire?
No, what happens in training. I couldn't care less about what anyone wants to take from any training session in the world. If we want to start talking about training sessions, the body of work I could tell the world about I've done in training across the planet is ridiculous. Do you know what I mean? You'd be sitting here going, oh my God, this kid's already the greatest of all time. But we don't do that. It's training. We're learning. We're growing. All that matters is can he and can I go out there and do what we say we want to do Saturday night, UFC, December 7th. That's all that matters.
Just on the preparation, and there was a relatively late change, obviously, with the champion being injured. I think it's a bone infection. So just how did you cope with that, the change in dynamic and preparation, preparing for a fight of this magnitude with a few kind of extra hurdles to overcome in that regard?
God gifted me an opportunity, a golden opportunity to go out and take the world over by going out here and finishing Shavkat Rakhmonov. And I'm going to take it. I'm going to go through this man with everything that I possibly can, get my hand raised Saturday night, and be the next person in line for that title.
The worldwide training journey that you've taken ahead of such a, what is sure to be a spectacular showdown on Saturday, given that you've kind of learned different styles of fighting as well, from Brazil to Thailand, obviously you're in America now at the moment as well, and you've been based back closer to home. How big of an advantage, how beneficial has that been to your career overall, do you feel?
Amazing. I mean, when you travel the world and you see different looks and you learn from different professors around the world and all of these guys who have built up, like, for example, when I think about jiu-jitsu, my two jiu-jitsu coaches right now in the world are Charles Oliveira, who is arguably the most flashy, fast, snappy jiu-jitsu in the world and that the UFC has ever seen. And then on the other side of that, I've got Damian Maia, the most fundamentally sound jiu-jitsu practitioner we've ever seen in MMA. I have a perfect combination of both. And to be able to learn from people like them by traveling the world, it's a privilege and an honor. And I'm very aware of how blessed I am. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to live this life.
I'm right in saying Charles is going to be in your corner on Saturday?
He is indeed. Yep, I'm excited for that. We got the full energy. The Shoot the Box family will be in. Will be in the corner, and we're going to go out there and take this win.
When you're traveling the world, and there's some great social media videos, and I encourage any listener to Google them and have a look on all your social media platforms. But the family support network that you have when you're traveling, how on a personal level, and just even stepping away from the fighting side, how important is that to you?
Family is everything to me, and traveling the world on my own and doing all of the great things I'm doing wouldn't mean anything if I didn't have my wife, my kids, my team, the people I want to be surrounded by enjoying the process with me. The journey is the gift. Enjoy it with the people you have with you, and it makes it 10 times better.
Hmm. I'm going to pose a question. I'm going to say, if you win, I'm sure you'll correct me by saying win.
that's a habit of mine.
if you are victorious then on Saturday, what's next on the cards? Would it be a case of title shot?
Well, the Dana, when he announced the fight, said that this is for the number one contender spot. So whoever wins on Saturday night is next for the title. I will be winning the world title next year, I'd imagine June, July, and I will beat Bilal Muhammad with absolute ease, and Ireland will have another belt brought back to the country. I will bring that belt back to Irish soil. The Emerald Isle deserves another UFC belt, and you're looking at the guy who's going to do it.
Is visualization a big thing, like in terms of you're saying what's going to happen Saturday, you're already looking ahead to next summer and that confidence that just oozes from you, but is that something that you go to sleep thinking of these things?
It's hard not to focus on visualization, because when you manifest in your mind and you speak it to the people you surround yourself with and you start going, I know this is going to happen, I feel it. For me, what I feel like it is if you have a strong spiritual connection and you can really understand your mind and your body and you can slow everything down and listen, it's all given to you. The plan and the path to victory and a happy life is gifted to you. If you just breathe and slow everything down, all I have to do is be present and enjoy the journey. It's done. It's laid out. I'm simply here to receive.
Was that always the case for you, even when you were starting off in your career, or did you have to kind of train your mind some way in that regard?
As you mature, you start to understand more and more and more the power of your own mind, the power of your own body. I think, like, for a 16-year-old who has a dream, it's hard for them to really understand the power that they possess inside them to make that happen. But undeniable faith in yourself, be completely unapologetic to anyone in the world who says you can or can't do it, and just focus on yourself and be determined and driven enough to prove that you can achieve your own dream, whatever that dream is, if you work hard enough. That's the lessons I've learned.
Well, on that
and surround yourself with people. Surround yourself with people that love you and care about you enough to tell you when you're right and tell you when you're wrong, to keep you on track and to help you achieve those goals. Because I wouldn't be anywhere without my wife. She helps guide me every day. She helps educate me every day on everything that I'm doing. I wouldn't be able to be here without her. Mm. And it's one person at a time. Find these people that you add to your life that are friends, family, people you meet at a coffee shop that are just good energy every day, that help push you in that direction.
Well, listen, on that positive note, Ian, we'll leave the conversation there, and I sincerely wish you all the very best on Saturday. There's no point even asking. There's only going to be one outcome in your eyes, isn't there?
Always.
Listen, always. Ian, thanks so much for taking the call.
I appreciate it, man. Have a great day, Shane, and all the best. Thank you so much.
Game on. Football.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On as we chat football, because there are 6 Premier League matches this evening. Keith Tracy is still with me. Peter Smith is also on the line. But before we preview this evening's matches, just looking back on last night's matches, Crystal Palace had a 1-0 win away to Ipswich Town. But Leicester City had a 3-1 victory over West Ham. Ruud van Nistelrooy, perfect start.
Yeah, great start, and it's so difficult for me. I look at the Leicester team, and I think they've issues in the middle of the pitch. The back four that started for them last night is Justin, Cody, Vestergaard, and Christensen as the left back, and it's a back four you look at and you think that's going to concede so many goals. But I didn't see the game. I was watching the women's international, but as soon as Jamie Vardy scored, I bet you West Ham were playing a silly high line, and Vardy got in behind within 2 minutes, and that's exactly what happened. A ridiculous high line that West Ham have been persisting with all season under Julian Lopetegui. And performances are one thing, but can repeatedly doing the same thing over and over and over, and that high line for West Ham just does not suit them whatsoever. Going forward, I think they look okay when Bowen is on the wing and Antonio plays through the middle. They've got a little bit of class up top, but defensively, absolutely all over the place.
Is his race ran? I know there's, I think, a decision by this weekend is the official line from West Ham. They play Wolves on the Monday evening as well, so there's a bit of time to mull over it, but it kind of...
It's not looking good for Lopetegui at all. His CV is absolutely brilliant when you look at some of the clubs he's been at and some of the stuff he's done, but it just doesn't look like it's going to click at West Ham. Week after week you keep thinking maybe it will click, maybe you will see some sort of progression with them, but you don't see it. They seem to take a step forward and then two steps backwards. So I look, when they sacked David Moyes, or they let David Moyes go, I thought there's not an awful lot of room for improvement with this West Ham team, given how well they were doing under David Moyes. And I think, you know, it's just one of those things that the grass is not always greener on the other side, and you can't demand the team play a certain way. Tactics don't win football matches, players do. And if you say that this manager's going to come into this team and apply this set of tactics, it's great on paper, but it doesn't always work, doesn't always translate into the dressing room. And I think that's where West Ham find themselves at the minute.
Okay, looking ahead at this evening's matches, team news is in. Nunes, Jones, Kwanzaa are in for Liverpool. Alexander-Arnold, Diaz, Szoboszlai are all out. Alexander Isak starts for Newcastle. Matt Doherty starts for Wolves, one of four changes. Chelsea make seven changes, including a change in their goalkeeper as well. But we're going to go to Peter Smith, who was at Manchester City ahead of Nottingham Forest, who will bring us the team news from Manchester.
Yes, Pep Guardiola has made four changes in a bid to rediscover the winning habit. In come Guardiola. De Bruyne is back. So too is Grealish and Doku. So three very attack-minded players there. Walker drops down to the bench. Foden, Nunes and Lewis miss out altogether. And there are three alterations to the Nottingham Forest 11. Returning are Dominguez, Moreno and Elanga, with Williams, Anderson and Hudson-Odoi all named amongst the substitutes.
Peter, I'm always drawn, and I don't know if it went viral in England, but it did over here, that famous Mick McCarthy press conference where I think a journalist posed the question of, this bad run can't continue, surely this can't go on, and it's just real deadpan, it can. So this Manchester City run, surely this can't go on in the form it is.
I agree, I don't think it will. Can I make a really bold statement?
Yeah.
And people might think I'm daft. I think City are going to win the title this year. And people will say, don't be stupid, don't talk daft. No, I think they'll really turn it around. And everybody's saying 11 points, you can't catch Liverpool, they're way in the distance. This old, should we hand it over to them? No. The old maxim of titles are usually won in May, not in the last week of November or the first week of December. And for me, City will get it right. They're more than capable of winning 10, 11 games come 2025. Liverpool have got to come here. Liverpool haven't had a blip as yet. And I've been around journalistically many, many years to know that Manchester United in the early 90s under Sir Alex Ferguson, they had 14 and 15 point leads over Blackburn Rovers and had those pegged back. Twice they were 14 and 15 points ahead in 94 and 95, I think, and Blackburn Rovers drew level with them. I know that United won the title 1 year and Blackburn won it the year afterwards, but we've seen it happen before. Big leads can and do evaporate, and I don't see Liverpool being 11 points ahead of Manchester City come 38 games played. So you can hold me to this. I'm predicting that City will make it five in a row.
You've just booked yourself on the show for later in the season. That's all you've done there, Peter.
That's the only reason why I'm saying it. No, seriously. Seriously, I believe, I know that in our industry now we hype everything up and everything is scrutinised. But I think what we have to realise as well, you and Keith tell me, a manager who's been dominant, who's never had a spell like this. Let's look at the greatest ever, the great Bob Paisley. People underestimate how brilliant he was at Liverpool. But every now and again, he had a blip, didn't he? And I remember vividly the 81-82 season, and Graham Souness still talks about it. They had a really, really poor festive period. They lost down to Manchester City, and one of the big national newspapers ran big banner headlines. He dragged them out every now and again. The Anfield empire has crumbled. And Liverpool then went on to win the League Cup a few months later and won the title on the last day of the season. It's happened with Manchester United and Sir Alex Ferguson. They've had indifferent seasons as well. They've had times when they've lost games of football. My only surprise is that where Manchester City's blip is concerned, it's taken 6 years. You know, 6 years of excellence, five league titles in that particular period, League Cups, FA Cups, Champions League. They'll get over it, and believe me, they'll be a dominant force again at some point very soon.
Well, Keith, what do you make of that bold statement from Peter Smith?
Yeah, look, I would be reluctant to write City off just yet, but you look at the performances. When you look at the talent within the dressing room, you do look at it and think it's only a matter of time before it clicks. Last week, I was thinking when Ruben Diaz came back into the squad, I was thinking that should give them a little bit more steel, stop conceding those silly goals, stop making those silly mistakes. But the silly mistakes kept on coming. And when you put it under a microscope and you look, right, well, individually, who's performing well, who's not performing? The fact that Rodri's out of the team, Kevin De Bruyne is only really coming back to starting to find his fitness. Bernardo Silva's been really poor this season, really, really poor. He was awful last weekend. Foden has been really poor. He finds himself on the bench. Jack Grealish is yet to score a goal in the Premier League, as is Bernardo Silva and Phil Foden. Ilkay Gundogan, I thought, was a brilliant signing when he came back, but initially now he looks a little bit leggy, looks a little bit off. It doesn't look the player he was when he left Manchester City. Mateus Nunes, I know he's a centre midfielder, but playing out on the left wing against Liverpool, I just didn't see it. It hasn't been good enough. Another one who hasn't really hit the ground running, hasn't scored any goals. And Savinho, a winger that's come in, I love watching him play. He puts me on the edge of my seat. But in terms of goals and assists, it hasn't really clicked for him yet. So there's a lot of question marks over a lot of these big stars within the Manchester City team. And look, people talk about Haaland. Haaland has 12 Premier League goals this season. If a couple of the other boys start to chip in, I think Manchester City will win games fairly easily. But the fact that Josep Guardiola, left-sided centre-half, is the second highest top goalscorer at City, you know, with the talent they have in the dressing room, with the players I've already mentioned, that's not good enough. It's just not good enough. And I'm sure Pep Guardiola will be cracking the whip left, right and centre. But it seems to be Ederson, the goalkeeper, who's getting the brunt of it at the minute. He's been dropped twice. I know Phil Foden has found himself on the bench, but it looks like Ederson is getting the wrath of Pep at the minute.
Yeah, City only keeping 2 clean sheets in 13 Premier League matches. Sticking with the Manchester theme, because Peter, I believe you were at the Manchester United match last weekend, and I was reading in the Racing Post, and credit to Mark Langdon, friend of the show, Oasis aren't the only Mancunians mounting a comeback. It's early days, but the signs from Ruben Amorim's fledgling Manchester United reign have been positive. The Portuguese has wasted little time in implementing his master plan, bringing energy in a fresh direction to the Red Devils. Will that energy and fresh direction continue away to Arsenal this evening, Peter?
I think this is the real test for them, isn't it? I mean, since Mr. Ten Hag departed company with the club, they've never really had a proper acid test. You know, Ruud van Nistelrooy's games in charge, Chelsea probably provided the sternest test, and that was a drawn game. A couple of wins over Leicester for van Nistelrooy, and a win in Europe as well against Greek opposition that weren't particularly good. And then Amorim taking charge again, playing sides that are not the strongest. I know that he's unbeaten, obviously, having drawn at Ipswich and beaten Bodo Glimt and beaten a very, very poor Everton side on Sunday. But you know, you've still got to make sure you don't lose, and they haven't lost in that sense. But this is a proper test tonight. I think this is going to be a real barometer of where Manchester United are up to. If they can go and really put a good challenge in at the Emirates, then, yeah, people will start believing in Amorim. But let's see how good they are tonight over 90 minutes. This a really, really good yardstick for them.
Do you think they'll put it up to Arsenal, Keith?
Possibly. I think it depends what sort of Manchester United turn up. They've been a little bit all over the place, a little bit inconsistent. And obviously with the new manager coming in, there's so many new ideas, new tactics, new way of doing things, that it is going to be a little bit all over the place to start with. But the one thing for me is, you know, again, people are saying Ruben Amorim's coming in with these tactics and Manchester United are magically going to win games. Tactics don't win games of football. Players win games of football, and the players are still the same that Manchester United have. You look at Ugarte and Casemiro. off the ball, I don't think they're mobile enough, I don't think they're robust enough, I don't think they're combative enough to play in a really high energy midfield that Manchester United need. The one bright spark for me is Amad Diallo. I think he's been excellent. The young man trotting down the wing, been really, really good. Yeah, if I'm looking for a Marcus Rashford, has he turned the corner? Does he look a little bit more interested? I don't really think so. Although he's starting to score a few goals, his body language is still pretty much the same for me. So the worrying thing is the question marks are still there that were there under Ten Hag. The question marks that were there with Van Nistelrooy are still there. The players are still the same. Bruno Fernandes, question marks. Xherdan, question marks. And you know, with Martinez being suspended, Maynou being suspended tonight, you just think Odegaard, Saka as well, that relationship that them two have. Since Odegaard's come back into the Arsenal team, Arsenal look like he can score goals again. Saka looks a better player, although he wasn't really suffering. It's I expect with set pieces and everything else that Arsenal can bring to it, I expect we will have enough, but it largely comes down to what sort of Manchester United team turns up tonight.
Okay, that is the later kickoff, 8:15, as is Aston Villa, Brentford. The rest of the matches are on at 7:30. Manchester City, Forest, Newcastle, Liverpool, Southampton, Chelsea and Everton, Wolves. On the Newcastle Liverpool match, if this bold statement is to come true and materialise, Peter, will Newcastle do you a favour this evening?
Well, possibly. I mean, the big talk about Newcastle at the moment is how do they progress? Because last season, of course, they were competing in the Champions League. They didn't qualify for Europe. Apparently, they've got access to more money than any football club on earth, but they can't spend it with the new profit and sustainability rules. And that's the thing. You know, where can Newcastle go from here? They are a decent side. They can give Liverpool a game and pose them one or two problems, but in terms of moving forward, I just don't know how they're going to do it. I think their turnover is around 300 million compared with 500 million for some of the more established teams, you know, the Cities and the Arsenals and the Liverpools of this world. So it's a great club with magnificent support. They really haven't been able to kick on from that top four finish from Champions League last season. And I just think that perhaps they're going to be sort of mid to higher table for the foreseeable future unless they can find some way of bridging that £200 million gap. But in terms of tonight, sure, they'll give Liverpool something to think about, but Liverpool have been brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And fair play to Slot for not having a big ego and having to change things. So many managers come in and have to do it their way and put their own imprint on it and their own stamp on it. To be able to just allow the old ship to sail on, you know, recognising that Jurgen Klopp left him something good. But then again, I remember a manager called Bob Paisley who did something similar when Bill Shankly left him a great team, and look what they went on to do. So who's to say Liverpool can't do similar again?
That is fair. Keith, you have a sneaky feeling, am I right in saying they might drop points this evening?
Yeah, well, I fancy Newcastle. Whenever Newcastle play at home under the lights, I always fancy them. I know how difficult it is to go up there and play a game. The Geordies will have the place absolutely bouncing. And with Newcastle sitting in 11th, you look at them on paper, really, really strong team as individuals, but they've lost against West Ham, Brighton, Fulham this season. They've lost to Chelsea, and Chelsea is the one you look at and think, if you want to be, you know, in that Champions League race, you need to be beating the likes of Chelsea, Fulham, Brighton. And they've drew against Crystal Palace, Everton and Bournemouth, so already 15 points behind Liverpool. I do worry a little bit for Eddie Howe, given the finances they have available, that they might just try and change things up. But Liverpool, I know we can sit here and talk about Salah, McAllister, Luis Diaz, Gakpo, Nunes. Defensively, they've been absolutely rock solid. Van Dijk looks as good as ever. It's just the Kanate injury. You're looking at that and thinking, is that something that could maybe unnerve Liverpool a bit? And Trent Alexander-Arnold not starting at right back, I think, is maybe Slot having a look and thinking we need people to defend today. And that's probably why Joe Gomez looks like he's going to be starting at right back.
I think there was a report in The Athletic today that contract talks have opened up at Van Dijk and possibly Salah as well. Just briefly before we do wrap up the show, Wolves and Everton, an absolute must win for both teams, both conceded 4 at the weekend. Just briefly, Chelsea, you'd imagine they'll continue their good run of form at the start of the season away to Southampton this evening?
Yeah, you'd imagine they've so much talent on the wings, brilliant players through the middle. They can control games as well through the middle on the wings. And Southampton, I think, will be their own biggest enemy. I think Chelsea will set traps in the press for them to allow them to play out to a certain area, then go and pick their pockets and go straight for the jugular. So the worrying thing I see about Southampton is I don't see them learning. I keep hearing Russell Martin saying we need to stay true to ourselves. That'll be brilliant, but you stay true to yourself, it'll be a matter of time before you find yourself back in the Championship. So I do think they have have to find something else to do. But, you know, losing against Chelsea tonight isn't going to relegate Southampton.
OK, great stuff. Peter Smith, enjoy Manchester City versus Nottingham Forest. Keith Tracy, thanks so much for popping into the studio. Before we wrap up, competition, our winner of the competition, a big thanks to everyone who texted in. Galway, as the county that Joe Canning played for, we've picked one correct entry randomly and that person is going to get themselves €400, all thanks to Kellogg's. So congratulations to Marion McDonough. You're tonight's winner. And if you missed out today, don't worry, because we'll be back doing it all again tomorrow. Big thanks to Andrew O'Connor producing this evening's show. Laura Lee Davis was our broadcast coordinator. Bette De Silva is up next with the new music show and I shall speak to you at 6 o'clock tomorrow. So from all of the Game On team, it is bye for now.